In their book from John Wiley and Sons, Retrofitting Suburbia, Urban Design Solutions for Redefining Suburbs, Ellen Dunham Jones and June Williamson say that the last 50 years have been dominated by the reproduction of sprawl development patterns, and that the next 50 years will have to be spent making that sprawl sustainable. They were on the show in April, and we thought that we would air our conversation again to kick off the 4th of July weekend. I started off by asking them, if I'm not an architect or an urban planner, why should I be interested in this book?
Well, I think it affects all of us that a majority of Americans live in suburbs, in suburban areas, and we're expecting growth to continue to be occurring in this country, and we need to think about where and how that growth is going to occur, and it affects everyone.
The majority of Americans live in the suburbs?
Yes, as of the 2000 census.
But
more Americans, in fact, live in suburbs than live in center cities or rural areas.
And you say that they have an adverse effect on the environment. Is it because people have to drive into the local urban center?
Well, part of this is that the sprawling development patterns that we've been building for this past half century are not sustainable, in the sense that they are have a very large carbon impact on the environment and produce a lot of emissions.
Ellen, in your title, you use the word retrofit. What do you mean by that?
By retrofitting, we distinguish from simply renovating an existing property to actually changing its use. One of the characteristics of suburban development is that it's very single use. Your one-acre housing is located over here. Your quarter-acre housing is over there. The mall is in another location, and the office park in yet another, and requiring that we drive everywhere. And in the retrofits that we focus on, there is a trend to take properties that are not performing very well. They've gotten older. They've aged. They're no longer bringing in the rent that they at one point they were, and they're not really serving current needs. And it's retrofitting them to make them more mixed use, to add somewhat higher densities, so that people can actually substitute a lot of those driving trips for walking or bike, and to make transit much more feasible in the suburbs. And it has a very large impact on the amount of time that people have to then devote to other interests. They're not in their cars so much. They're healthier because they're walking more often. There are a whole lot of great impacts that come from that.
What should I make of the fact that General Growth Properties Incorporated, the second largest U.S. mall owner, filed for bankruptcy protection today?
That's a really big story, and one we've been actually following pretty closely. We devoted an entire chapter in our book to a General Growth Properties project that I thought was really innovative. It was doing a lot of, I think, really very good things. The Cottonwood Mall outside of Salt Lake City, it's already been demolished, and they were in the process of reconstructing it as a very mixed-use town center. And General Growth really was doing several innovative things. They built housing at the mall, at their Natick Mall. They were repositioning a lot of their properties, and I think in some very forward-looking ways, but they did over-leverage and borrow too much money during the boom years in order to do that. And like everybody else whose mortgages exceeded their grasp during the boom years, they're paying the price.
But the older suburbs had these mixed-use town centers, didn't they, before the malls? Was, for example, I think of Long Island, and I think of towns like Rockville Center and Hempstead and Garden City. They served the function of a mall before there was a mall.
Well, one of the lessons in the research, and one of the things we want to get across, is that suburbs are very diverse. And there are suburban areas that were built in the late 19th century and the early part of the 20th century that were characterized by town centers, walkable, mixed-use town centers.
So what happened?
Well, the post-war expansion really changed the scale of development, expanded it greatly, and with the codification of separated use zoning in newly developing areas, plus the introduction of the automobile, you really had a very new paradigm for development where the shopping areas in particular and the other uses were separated, as Ellen has described. So in the Northeast, certainly in this area, the expansion and growth of these malls often led to deterioration or decline in those old main streets. And part of the retrofitting does involve the rebirth of those areas. But then in other areas, some of these post-war suburbs, they never had an old town center. And so the mall, repurposing, retrofitting the mall becomes an opportunity to create a center that some of these suburbs never had.
And then you say that a more recent development, the big box stores like Walmart and Home Depot, they've had a really negative impact on the local communities.
Ellen,
yes,
why don't you take
that?
We've
seen lots of examples of entire small towns, especially in more rural parts of America, where Walmart really originated, started off first in the rural markets and then gradually moved to the suburban and now only more recently to the urban markets. But they've had a really quite devastating effect on a lot of local mom and pop retailer, Main Street retailers. But one of the really interesting things about why we're starting to see so many suburban retrofits right now, I think has to do with the fact that our development pattern for the last 50 years has basically been one of leapfrogging. Each new development opens 5 or 10 miles further out on cheaper land, just assuming people will keep driving further and further out. And as that process has continued, the new, shinier developments take market share away from the older ones, and they typically go into decline, not all of them, but a large number. But we've been doing it for so long that what's interesting is that a lot of those bypassed earlier, older suburban malls, office parks, subdivisions, that they were at the edge of development when they were built. But now they've been leapfrogged so much, they actually have a new, relatively central position in their metropolis. And that's what's beginning to really drive this redevelopment, because suddenly now they have a relatively close-in location. And it requires a change of mindset, but that's why we begin to see them urbanizing, becoming that much denser with a walkable network of streets. And it also has a lot to do with changing demographics as well.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with my guests. Ellen Dunham-Jones and June Williamson, authors of a book called Retrofitting the Suburbia, Urban Design Solutions for Redesigning Suburbs. It is published by Wiley. It's got lots of pictures, we should point out. And although I assume that urban planners and architects and people who are professionals in the field will find this book the most useful, it really does address issues that we've all thought about and that we all have to be concerned about. We will continue right after this. We're back with an interview I did in April with architecture professors Ellen Dunham-Jones and June Williamson about their book, Retrofitting Suburbia, Urban Design Solutions for Redefining Suburbs, and we are re-airing it for you today. One of the things I asked them about was why so little attention had been paid to the redesign and redevelopment of existing out-of-date suburbs and whether the elected representatives in these areas have been aware of problems arising.
Well, one of the things that we mention in the book is research that has indicated that at the federal policy level, there's been a sort of blind spot in terms of supporting the programs and needs of these inner suburban areas, many of which are experiencing the kinds of problems and stresses that we've traditionally associated with the inner city in terms of crime, education, very diverse populations where many immigrants communities are going directly to suburban enclaves rather than to the traditional arrival points for immigrants. So there's that, as well as the aging infrastructure in these areas and so forth. Now, the local communities, I think one of the challenges here, which is also being addressed by researchers, is the condition of fractured governance. So you have many small municipal governments who in the growth expansion periods were in competition with one another to bring in new development and so forth in order to bolster their tax base.
They even compete with police
departments and fire departments,
schools,
things that that probably would be best to cooperate with.
Yes, and I think some of the more successful areas in terms of retrofitting work or putting in new transit systems are parts of the country that are dominated by county government, for example, rather than township government. So there's more opportunity for coordinated planning.
Well, who works that out? Does the county then come up with new zoning plans? Or don't these towns have to agree to participate?
That's the challenge,
really. And we see different patterns playing out in different communities. But absolutely, most of these projects are public-private partnerships. Many cases, the local mall dies and it defaults and becomes the property of the local community, and so they have to now find someone to redevelop it. In some cases, it is mall owners like General Growth Properties who are seeking to reposition their properties. But there's the larger coordination of really getting in new transit systems. Those larger projects absolutely do require a government that is committed to change. And we also do see that this happening more often in areas that have really seen an influx of young professionals out into the suburbs. Places like Denver and D.C. are good examples. And the suburbs, we still tend to think of them as being dominated by the Ozzie and Harriet sort of household, the very familiar sort of image. And yet since 2000, 65% of households in suburbia have not had children in them. And yet suburban job growth is enormous.
You also say that the stereotypical white suburbs is not really true either.
It never has been entirely true. It's always been a stereotype, but not the reality.
How much diversity is there, and how? What about the image that we get from all those people who leave the suburbs, the kids who say, "Well, the suburbs are boring because they're just so oatmeal."
I think that's part of how this media stereotype that continues to be perpetuated, we might call it a dystopia even, are young creative people who've grown up in suburbs, perhaps more the affluent and more kinds of that sort of suburb, then move to the city and in their creative work continue to portray this image of the sort of soul-deadening suburb. But if you really look at the research, and there are a lot of historians who are doing very important research going back throughout the 20th century and recognizing the diverse communities that have always characterized suburbia.
Which ones need the most retrofitting? The pioneer suburban areas or the more recent ones which have kind of been slapped together?
I would say all of the above, except perhaps some of the most elite suburban areas that have held their value and are quite satisfied with their current conditions. But most other suburban areas are experiencing some sort of challenge. And really, part of this is this understanding that suburban areas are constantly in flux and changing.
Now, there were all of these suburban office and industrial parks developing in the suburbs. I always assumed that was because the top management of these companies wanted to be able to work closer to home. Aren't a lot of those places closing?
We are seeing quite a lot of change in the office parks. Most of the changes are coming in malls in particular. We're seeing a lot of dead malls being retrofitted. But there are several examples of office parks and industrial parks. They tended to have been better built, and they've been lasting that much longer. So we're sort of just at the start, I think, of the wave of that redevelopment. But University Town Center is a very interesting retrofit about 9 miles outside of D.C., in Prince George's County, which is there were three originally built in the 60s, but now four office buildings, 10-story substantial buildings, and their parking lots are now being infilled with a new Main Street, multi-story residential above shops, and some embedded parking garages, and it's really becoming a much more urban place and becoming a much sort of, you know, in many respects, a hipper place now to work, and it's attracting young people to both live there and work there. And we're seeing in general that the old stereotype of the sort of office park dad, office park says boring, the television show The Office portraying office life, sort of suburban office life that way, we're seeing offices now wanting to locate in more diverse, more urban neighborhoods. And so that's part of what is driving some of these kinds of retrofits.
Now, when you talk about all of these malls dying, is it because they're being replaced by larger malls, the older malls, the smaller ones now having to compete in the same way that the mom-and-pop stores have to compete with the Walmarts?
There certainly is a kind of a vicious competitive cycle that has been associated with retail development in an almost cannibalistic way. And a lot of these properties were built for a very short a time period because of accelerated depreciation, tax policy, the relatively low cost of initial cost, first cost of the land, is leading to this condition where even some of the chain retailers expect to close their own properties as they build a newer, bigger store. They expect that they'll close down some of their own stores. So it really is a real competitive market for retail.
I don't know if it was inspired by your book, but today the New York Times Room for Debate blog is posing the question of what happens or what should happen to dying or dead shopping malls.
Yes, and we participated in that debate because they're popping up all over the place in a somewhat increasing frequency. This trend has been going on for some time in terms of a bigger, newer mall leading perhaps to the decline of other malls that don't get redeveloped. But with certain chain big box retailers going under, you're seeing an increase in the number of empty stores. And we observe and document in the book a number of very creative reuses for those properties.
Well, you mentioned earlier that the suburbs are so reliant on the automobile. And one of the criticisms has been that people don't walk as much in the suburbs, and that may be leading to other health problems, obesity. It also, of course, is creating more greenhouse gases. Has there been any attempt to urbanize some of the suburbs to the point where people will walk around a bit more and actually get to know their neighbors?
That's part
of the... We're actually finding, yeah, there's some very interesting research on this. And one project here in Atlanta, Atlantic Station, is a large redevelopment of it was actually a steel mill, but right in the center of Atlanta. It's been redeveloped as a new urbanist, more compact, mixed-use development. And whereas the average employed Atlantan drives a rather shocking 66 miles a day on average, the average employee at Atlantic Station drives 10.8 miles a day, and the average resident only 8 miles a day. And that does produce a lot more time for people to, you know, it improves environmental health, it improves their own health, it gives them a lot of time to do more things. And we see it attracting, in particular, both the sort of empty nester market and as well as the young professional market, who really kind of enjoy living and working in a mixed-use environment where there's nightlife, there's activity, a lot of the things that the suburbs have not previously offered.
But some of the older suburbs also have a lot of public transportation, don't they? The big problem there being that it's often quite expensive to commute.
That is part of the challenge, and additional part of this is affordable housing and how to be able to integrate more affordable housing types for people at different stages of their lives into their existing home communities. And to follow up a little bit on the earlier point about walkability, this is where urban design comes into this, because it's really important how these retrofits are designed, how they're configured, how the streets are connected through the provision of sidewalks and squares and parks, civic public space where people can congregate and gather and be together.
I used to live in a small town called Valley Cottage, and this in Rockland County. And just to get a container of milk, I had to get into the car and drive to the closest store. If I want to do any serious shopping, it was a longer drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just so pleased now that I am back in the city where I can walk to practically any place I have to go.
I think one of the things that we found in discussing this book, though, is that some suburbanites are somewhat threatened by the idea that we're proposing that they're going to have to give up their cars or their yards. And really what we're talking about here is the introduction of higher density nodes that provide housing choice for people who would prefer to live in a closer area, mixed-use area, where they can forego car trips, maybe even not even use their car for a couple of days at a time. And then other people can continue with their other choices.
We have a slideshow of images from your book on our show page at WNYC.org. My great thanks to my two guests, Jane Williamson, Associate Professor of Architecture at the City College of New York City, CUNY, and Ellen Dunham Jones, Associate Professor and Director of the Architecture Program at the College of Architecture at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.